On first hearing that this atom bomb had been dropped and of its destructive power and whatnot, I immediately, in my mind, had an understanding of what that was all about. And I've often wondered how come I was so naive to not have recognized that before and perhaps not taken that job at Westinghouse. And other opportunities I'm certain were available if I had had the right contacts or if people, teachers and others had been on their toes and had been directing me. Perhaps they were. I think there were people who were encouraging me to take that job at Westinghouse, but I wanted to stay there in Zion. I didn't have any desire to traipse off to Pennsylvania. Well, somewhere along the line, the war with the Germans ended. And I'm wondering if that didn't happen when we were in Brunswick, Maine. I'm pretty sure that I remember Roosevelt died and Truman came into power as president while we're in Brunswick, Maine. And I guess it's Truman who decided to drop the bomb. Anyway, I've lost track of where the war with Germany ended. But with the Japanese, that ended while I was there in the Boston area. Well, Mom was home, so she didn't get to see this part, but I went out on the streets with everybody else. And the streets of Boston, Cambridge, everywhere, just everyone. There were no one in their houses. Everybody was outside. And whistles and sirens and lights and fireworks and firecrackers and just one big mass demonstration of, gratitude, I guess. The war was finally over. And, we were blacked out. When it comes to lights at night, they were afraid bombers might reach the United States, and the lights were out at night, and there were other security measures. But now, all the lights were back on, and everybody was really whooping it up, and that went on all night long. I didn't stay up all night, but I probably stayed up till past midnight on that thing before I went to bed. So I saw that experience that went on in all big cities. I heard the same thing of just everybody out into the streets, whooping it up, the war was over.
Did you have more to say?
I was, of course, extremely grateful that the war was over along with everybody else, and to know that any big, terrible war that finally ended would make your heart full of gratitude and, looking forward to being out of it and being back to a normal life, back to school and so on. Well, after the additional training at Honolulu Naval Base, I was assigned to my first ship. Let's see if I can remember what it was called. It was an electronics ship, a communication ship. In the old days of the Navy, I understand that the captain of the fleet or the commander of the fleet was on the battleship. But here, at least at the end of World War II, the big wigs, the big commanding top people, were on what were called AGC ships. And an AGC ship, I was on AGC 14. It had all the radar gear, all the communications. It only had light defense, just small guns. And it was intended that this ship be protected by the larger ships in the fleet and the fleet's aircraft. But this was the ship that was loaded from stem to stern with all of the detection equipment and all of the communications equipment. Now this ship actually stayed in the San Francisco Harbor for, I don't know how long, a couple of months, something like that. And I was the chief radar officer aboard that ship. I had a couple of enlisted men who worked for me to keep the radar in gear. the radar gear in shape. Now, this ship was scheduled to go to the Far East. Now the war was over. They were de-enlisting people, so to speak. You could get out of the Navy, and there was a point system for getting out. If you had a lot of kids, that was a lot of points to get you out. The years of service you'd had and this, that, and the other all counted towards how soon you would get out. Now, I was close enough to having enough points to get out that they decided to release me from the AGC, because if I'd have gone to the Orient, I could have been there maybe another 6 months or so, way past my due time to get out. Now, the Navy didn't have to let you out. If they felt they needed you, you could. I was in pretty good graces with the captain on the AGC. The full brass, you know, the commander of the fleet wasn't on that ship. A lesser man, commander as I remember it, was in charge of the ship because just sitting there in the harbor at that point, the war was over. But once the war was over, the Navy fell apart, so to speak. The stiff, firm discipline and shipshape sort of things just went by the board. I know shore leave was frequent, and the guys would go ashore and they'd bring girls back and take them down in all to the secret radar areas, and all the other Navy secrets were were laid open because nobody seemed to care. The war was over and whatnot, and discipline and morals and everything else, which had already pretty much gone to pot in the world, just all the more so. I would maintain the Navy discipline myself. I would salute the commander when I was supposed to, and I don't know, I just felt there's no reason to start acting like a slob. And the commander seemed to appreciate that. I never really saw anybody else take care of those things the way they're supposed to on the ship. And I would wear my Navy hat when I was supposed to, and wear the clothing I was supposed to. And I think the commander noticed that and liked that. And when I had an opportunity to go on leave, he let me go a little bit early so I could catch a train. That was an experience. I waited. You couldn't get a reservation on a train those days anyway, and with the war over and all the troops being transported home, it was almost impossible to get on a train. I went, purchased a ticket at the nearest place. I think it was, I can't think of the name of the place. It was the place where Sperry Mills had headquarters. You know, I worked for Sperry Mills in Ogden, and we were sort of a satellite of this place near San Francisco on the Oakland side, I believe, where they had grain facilities where grain could be brought from ships or loaded on ships. Anyway, I waited while train after train went by, and I'm telling you, trains would go by four or five every hour. Always filled, no room. And some of the trains that came by were troop trains, and there really was room, but the conductors wouldn't let me aboard. Well, finally, as I saw this, that a lot of these weren't really the regular trains, and I had a ticket, but you're supposed to have had some kind of a troop train ticket to be on these trains, and they weren't completely filled. I finally just sort of, you know, told the guy, man, this is the 100th train that gone by. I've been waiting all night. I've got to get on this train. So he let me on. And I walked through the train, and there were lots of, it was Army, no Navy on there. But there were Army officers and lots of empty bunks. Well, I was too non-pushy in those days, so I went to a baggage area, and I just flopped out on top of the baggage, slept what I could. But the next morning, one of the Army guys came by, and he says, "You sleep up here all night?" And I said, "Yes." He says, "Well, we could have given you a good bed back there in the officers' section of the train." So, anyway, good to get home again. After leaving that ship, I was assigned to the Oakland Navy Depot as officer in charge of electron tube storage. I never believed that the world could manufacture as many electron tubes as they had stored there. There was really not much to do, and that warehouse was so mixed up. They had given me the assignment to straighten out all the tubes and get everything organized. It got all mixed up. I don't know if that happened during the rush of the war or whatnot. But they just had millions and millions of dollars worth of tubes there. And I was just appalled at the way the regular Navy help and the civilian help that they had there treated things. The war was over. They were getting their pay. Nobody did anything. Sit around, play cards, drink coffee, tell dirty jokes. And they didn't care about those electron tubes. They would take their forklift and they'd just run into a batch of tubes that maybe cost a couple of $100,000 and break them all up. Nobody gave a darn. Anyway, there was so much time on my hands, and I knew I was going to go back to school when I got out, that I got out my physical chemistry book, and I just studied my physical chemistry book all day long, as much as I could stand. Learned it backwards and forwards. And that time was very well spent to have done that. Well, I finally was released from the Navy, I think, in April of 1946. I'd been in the service just about 2 years, maybe 1 month longer, 1 month shorter. I was eligible to become a lieutenant junior grade. See, early in the war, you advanced rapidly in rank, no matter where you were, and that was proper that that should be so, but I got in the war late, was not out in active areas of combat, and was advanced very slowly. But the war was over, and I didn't care, and I never did go to pick up my lieutenant JG grade rank, which I was eligible for. I was mustered out of the service, as I remember it, either at the Naval Depot in Clearfield. That was the place. There was a Naval Depot storage area in Clearfield, Utah, and was mustered out of the service at that point. Now, one advantage of being in the war is that you are now eligible for the GI Bill of Rights. And that paid something like $100 a month to you while you were going to school. And without that, I never would have been able to continue school. Now, my former teachers at the University of Utah, where I had obtained both my master's and bachelor's degree, principally Walter D. Bonner and Victor G. Baird, had sent a lot of their students to Purdue University, and they thought that's where I should go, and there was a specific man there in physical chemistry that they thought I ought to go there and work for. Forgotten that man's name. I believe it was... I've forgotten it. Well, so I made all the arrangements to go to Purdue University and was accepted there as a student. I was told to come out alone, and that later on I would be able to bring my wife. In about a month, they were building housing for students and their wives. Well, I took that risk and went out. When I got out there and surveyed the situation, they hadn't even started to build the accommodations that were supposed to be available for teaching assistants and their wives. I was going there as a teaching assistant. Hadn't even started to build them yet, and I could not find a thing in town anywhere that we could possibly have afforded. Furthermore, there was no place for you to work as a graduate student. I had a room all to myself for my master's degree research at the University of Utah. They didn't have a place for a student to hang his hat. At Purdue in those days, all freshmen had to take chemistry. They had that rule. Every entering freshman had to take chemistry. And there were thousands of freshman students. And so I recognized that the incoming students were just slave labor. We had to work for a couple of years as a student before they'd even let us start on our PhD. And I already had my master's degree, and this was disheartening. I took the various entrance examinations. I did very well in everything, particularly physical chemistry, and that was a result of studying Getman and Daniels till I knew it backwards and forwards. I didn't do too well in organic chemistry, and on that account I had to take their own special Purdue organic chemistry course, which it would slow you down some too. Well, after 6 weeks of this, I was really getting discouraged. And I wanted to get out of there, but a Dr. Haas, H-A-A-S, I forget his first name, was chairman of the department, and he wasn't going to let any of those graduate teaching assistants go. He had to have them to teach those freshman classes. There was supposed to be a new chemistry building constructed, but at this time, they just had an old chemistry area that was too small for what they needed. Well, Haas threatened to blackmail me if I should leave. He says, I'll fix it so you can never be a member of the American Chemical Society and never get enrolled at any other school and so on and so forth. I was kind of desperate. I had been sick with the flu there, which, you know, when your family's away, that didn't feel too good. There was no church there, and I couldn't locate any other Latter-day Saints in the area.
And Mom was getting very restless.
And so I decided, to heck with him, I'm going home anyway. I called Dr. Bonner, meantime, to see what I should do, and he called Yale University, and he said he could fix it up so I could go to Yale University and work for Harned. I considered that some, but I didn't think that was really what I ought to do. Now, there was another, by the way, the physical chemistry teacher that I was supposed to work for there didn't ever come back. He'd been out working on the atomic bomb during the war, and he didn't come back to Purdue. My teachers at Utah should have determined that was the fact before sending me out there. But there was a new young physical chemistry teacher there who had not, fresh out of school, no reputation yet and whatnot. And I talked to him about my problems, and he says, what you ought to do is to go back to school at the University of Utah. He says, a man by the name of Henry Eyring has just gone back there. He's a world famous chemist. And if you went back there, you could probably work for him. And if I were you, he says, I shouldn't say this to you because we need people here at Purdue. But he says, there's really no one here that has the reputation that is anywhere near this man, you know, with this other guy not coming back and he just being a young man who's just starting there. He says, there's really nothing for you here at Purdue. I'd just go back there. So I took that advice, went back to the University of Utah, and became Henry Eyring's first student, at least his first student to graduate under Henry Eyring at the University of Utah. I got my degree there in 1948, end of the summer term. I was the fourth PhD to graduate from the University of Utah. They had a medical school and were graduating lots of people in medicine at that August commencement. But I was the only PhD to graduate at that August commencement, and I can still hear the applause and how good that felt. There were so many medicals as commonplace, and they'd already been doing that. They got just ordinary applause, but as the only PhD, this hood was put on me by Henry Eyring, who was dean of the graduate school, and by A. Ray Alpin, who was the president of the university, and I've been very great friends of these two for a long time since graduating there, and also of Carl Christensen, who was the director of research at the University of Utah for many years, came about the same time as Eyring. During the period between the time I was released from the service and waiting for school to start in the fall, I had worked again at the U.S. Bureau of Mines and made a little bit of money during the summer. As a matter of fact, they would have taken me back full time, but I figured it was better to go on and get my Ph.D. We had considered quitting. We had lots of temptations, young and poor and hard to make ends meet. In the last quarter of my senior year in chemistry, I was tempted by offers from Sperry Flour Mills. I've forgotten the name of the boss there in the lab in Ogden, but he wanted me to go on full-time there with what seemed like a tremendous amount of money and all kinds of opportunity. And I said to him, yeah, but I don't want to just do these routine analyses all day. I want to do some research. Oh, you can have all kinds of opportunity to do that on the side when there's free time and whatnot, which really wasn't the case. But Ida Rose and I went to talk to Dr. Bonner about this temptation, and I don't remember the words he said, but just instantly we knew that we shouldn't do that thing, and I'm certainly glad he saved us from that. Because with my powerful interest in science, I wouldn't have belonged to the club of PhDs, and I never would have been able to do what I have been able to do. Well, after receiving that degree, I started to look for a job. That's not the way you ought to do it. You ought to be looking long before you get your degree. And we sent out postcards to various big companies, including the General Electric Company, who I'd always wanted to work for, asking if they had any employment opportunities. Well, the General Electric people said they did not have any, but DuPont, Eastman, and some other companies answered the postcard, sent me forms to fill out. All we were requesting with the postcard was send us some application forms. We wanted to save money on postage. We didn't have much money. But I learned on later at General Electric Company that they just assumed I was a no-good hillbilly because I'd sent in this postcard and was advised at the time I quit General Electric. They were talking to Glenn Giddings, who was the personnel officer. He gave me this, he wanted to give me this advice. If you ever apply for a job again, never send in a postcard. You know, that's just not done. And of course he was correct, but if you're a poor boy from the country, you don't know all the rules of etiquette. And after all, other companies had answered my postcard. Well, I went out on a recruiting trip. These companies all offering to pay my way. And I decided to call a General Electric company, or write two of them, I've forgotten which, and tell them that I was coming on this trip and couldn't I just please stop off in Schenectady since it was on the way and talk to them. Well, they reluctantly agreed to let me do that, but didn't offer me any funds for paying part of the trip. The other companies, we prorated the cost of that trip among all these companies. Most of the companies were surprised to learn that I had already graduated, because, as I say, I was kind of dumb. I should have been out looking for a job before I had actually arrived at the graduation point, but I waited until I had my degree in hand and then started looking for a job. There were job opportunities right there at the Bureau of Mines. I could have gone to work at the Bureau of Mines. I went on this trip, and they seemed to like me quite well at Eastman Kodak Company. When I arrived at Bound Brook, New Jersey, I went to see an old teacher of mine, former teacher of mine, Wangsgaard, Alton Wangsgaard, who had taught math to me in the ninth grade at Lewis Junior High School in Ogden. He had a PhD at that time, but couldn't get a job with his PhD in physics, and so he took a school teaching job. And of course, he knew his stuff in mathematics, and most of the grade school teachers that I had met prior to that time, I knew more mathematics than they knew. So I always liked him because he had all this firm, solid knowledge and could teach us the real, genuine stuff firsthand. He worked at that time for Union Carbide, as I remember, and he had me interview there for a job. I remember I wore a hat. In those days, you know, it looked like a proper young man, you wore a hat, and I left my hat at Wangsgaard's, and they came chasing me, just caught me at the train before I took off to give me my hat back. In those days, I also stopped off in that same general area because I knew the famous Harvey Fletcher, director of physical research at the Bell Telephone Laboratories, and I went to Sunday school class there, I think, in Short Hills, New Jersey area, where he was teacher of the gospel doctrine class, to make sure I could see this great man. I don't know whether I had nerve enough to go up and shake his hand or not, but at least, you know, I got to see him. At DuPont...
Well, later you got to be very good friends with him, didn't you?
Yeah. At DuPont, I interviewed in Wilmington, and I interviewed in three other locations. They sent me on down south, the place where they made paint and a place where they made textile stuff. There were three or four locations DuPont sent me to, and I was very well liked. They let it be known at every place that they really liked me and wanted to hire me. And later on were disappointed when I turned down a job offer, which I could work at any of those places. They all wanted me. Well, when I was back home in Salt Lake City, and we lived at this time in our lives, I guess we were living in Stadium Village. Stadium Village, let's see, forgotten the address. Anyway, it's where housing that had been moved in, housing that they had kept the Japanese in out in the desert areas of Utah in this temporary housing during the war when they thought the Japanese might turn traitor. They moved that housing in to near the university, and young couples got to live in that at a reasonable rent, which made life very enjoyable. Some of the happiest times of our life were there. We seemed to get along very well on our $100 a month, plus a little extra that I would earn here and there, and then with all these other young people.
I remember you making us toys by hand when we were little kids. You made me a little paper umbrella that went up and down, and you made me a little rocking.
I made little chairs, too, four little chairs mm-hmm. for all the kids, and I guess a rocking, little rocking bed, cradle. Yeah, that's right. Well, I got offers from everyone, all at about the same amount of money, somewhere around $5,900 a year, but no offer from General Electric. And I kept putting these other companies off, waiting for an offer from General Electric Company. And probably if I hadn't gotten an offer from General Electric Company, I may have gone to work at the Bureau of Mines there in Salt Lake City. Glad that didn't happen that way. Well, I called or wrote letters to this Glenn Giddings, who was in charge of personnel at General Electric, and oh, they had to keep waiting, didn't have results yet. I need to tell a little other background there. The man who spent the most time with me when I interviewed at General Electric was a fairly young man, probably only 4 or 5 years older than I, by the name of William Cass, Bill Cass, C-A-S-S. And he was very friendly. Well, he was friendly to everybody. He was just a really nice guy, nice type of person. He was very friendly to me and told me, frankly, he liked me, and he wished that they would hire me. He says, as a matter of fact, I want to tell you, he says, they don't want to hire you. He says, chairman of chemistry, a guy by the name of Abraham Lincoln Marshall and others who had looked at me, didn't want to hire me. He says, perhaps one of the reasons they didn't want to hire me is that they didn't like Henry Eyring too well. Now, I had good recommendations from Henry Eyring. Besides that, they had hired one of Henry Eyring's students one time, and he just turned out to be no good to them. They figured Henry was too theoretical, and that they needed guys with more practical training. Now, it was obvious to Cass that I had the practical training. I'd gone through the hoops with all of Henry Eyring's theoretical stuff, but I had a practical part to my thesis and a practical bent. He says he thought they, if I really wanted to be hired, he could talk them into hiring me. So he wanted to know what my wishes were under the circumstances he told me about. I told him I wanted to be hired. Well, I waited and waited and waited. And finally, a phone call came to me when I was in the library at the University of Utah studying. And this phone call was from Glenn Giddings, and it made me an offer of $6,200 a year, which was actually more than any of the other offers. Well, I talked to my friends, Carl Eyring and Henry Eyring. I had an offer from the U.S. Bureau of Mines, which was quite a bit less than that. I think probably $2,000 less, only $4,200 or something. I'd always preferred to work in Utah, and was somewhat torn between my desires to work for the General Electric Company, which was an offshoot of Edison, one of my heroes, and staying there in Zion, where I had the opportunity to work for the Bureau of Mines. And Eyring and Carl Christensen's advice was to take the job and go east. So we did. We had an old car, an old Plymouth that had been in a wreck. It leaned to one side. The inside of the car